Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, March 15th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to have a spoiler-filled conversation about Rose Glass's new film, Love Lies Bleeding. And later, we're going to share an interview with writer-director Rose Glass. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi.
BJ, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. We are fresh after the horrible, atrocious, hilarious discourse of somebody being a little too excited to see Love Lies Bleeding.
Oh yeah, I just read about that. That's unfortunate, to say the least.
Yeah, for those at home who don't know, I will put this in as kind words as possible, but someone showed up to Love Lies Bleeding with alcohol and drugs, and they went hog out and passed out and had to be escorted out by the authorities.
Yes. Yeah. Very excited to watch that movie, that person. I was also very excited to watch this movie in a more legal way, PJ.
I'm so proud of you for not doing that.
Thank you so much.
The bar is in hell.
Yeah, superhuman levels of restraint on my part, I'm sure. But no, I really enjoyed this movie. I know that you love this film. Let's kick things off here with general thoughts. What'd you think about this?
Oh, I love this movie so much. This, you know, it's hitting a lot of boxes for me of things that I like. It's a gritty noir film. It has Kristen Stewart. It has buff women. It's sweaty and just so transgressive and great. It's everything that I love.
We recently talked about Driveway Dolls, which falls more on like the comedic side of the Coen brothers' dividing line in their filmography. And when I was watching Love Lies Bleeding, I thought about the Coens a little bit. I mean, the Coens don't actually have anything to do with the making of this movie, but this film kind of feels a little bit more like their serious movies, that kind of like Americana noir that they do so well. So I wonder if Rose Glass was like influenced in any way by the tone that shows up in some of those Coen brothers' films. But at the same time, it feels like, you know, super unique and like very much her own thing. There's like this really fascinating blend of kind of like fantasy imagery and like this grounded sort of grimy noir stuff. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. What were the aspects of this movie that stood out to you? What did you want to shout out here in this pre-interview section?
So there's a couple of things that I really admired. So the fantasy elements that you're talking about, I really like, because I think Rose Glass, between this movie and her debut, Saint Maud, there's this connective tissue here of, is this really happening, or is this the way that we envision ourselves? Is this an idealized look at how we think we are or how we wish we are? And her movies don't give you definitive answers, which I really, really like. So that is something that I greatly, greatly admired. But also, I like having a movie with messy queer characters a lot. I've said this before on other podcasts, but I have a big struggle with the concept of quote unquote good representation, because I don't think that it exists, because what is good representation for one person could be oppressive representation for another. The bad representation obviously very much exists, but good is a little bit more subjective. And I think lately a lot of studios have been very afraid to portray queer characters as anything other than like perfect saints, because they're afraid of backlash, and it's meant that a lot of queer stories have gotten pretty gutless, and this movie has a lot of guts and a lot of teeth and a lot of muscle, and I like it a lot.
Yeah, and a lot of like just, you know, gnarly stuff in it. There's some gore in this movie that caught me by surprise. I have not seen Saint Maud, so I'm not sure, like, I need to go back and watch that movie, so I'm not sure exactly how it compares, but like, yeah, you could kind of tell that even though this movie is not a horror movie, you can kind of tell that somebody who, you know, came from the horror world made it, because there's some pretty gnarly stuff in here.
And something that I want to share, because I think it's very fun, is so when I saw this, I saw it for a Galentine's Day screening, and I'm not going to say who all was there, but I will say it was a smaller screening, and the overwhelming majority of the audience were other like famous queer women and mm-hmm. other sapphics. I have no idea how I got on this list. I'm very happy to be there. Thank you, A24, for putting me on this list. but it was very clear that a good chunk of people that were there because, oh, this is a queer story, and were not prepared for how hard this movie was going to lean into genre. And I did tell this story to Rose Glass. You'll hear this in the interview. But it was very fun to sit in that room and watch a bunch of people realize in real time, oh, this movie's not messing around.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, I mean, I know you actually had a long interview with her. You had like 30 minutes with her, which is awesome. And I love listening to that. And I'm excited for people to hear it. I don't want to take up too much time like in this spoiler discussion between you and I kind of want to like, you know, hit our main points and just like let people listen to that full conversation. So I'll just say that like Kristen Stewart was awesome in this movie as usual. It's kind of like, I take her for granted how great she is these days. But man, she's just killing it. And Katie O'Brien, I just found to be like really mesmerizing to watch. I've never seen her in anything. I don't know. Do you know anything about her? Is this her first movie or?
Oh, so Katie O'Brien's been around for a while, but she's been doing things on like Star Wars shows and Marvel shows where she hasn't really been given a lot to do. Like she definitely has characters. They talk, you know, she's in the shows. People recognize her. But this is the first movie that has really allowed her to be an actor and not just a very strong, like physically strong woman on screen, so fulfilling, you know, all of those roles that you have within, you know, Marvel and Star Wars sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, it's like, no, she gets to be an actor. She gets to have an interior life that we see and have conflict and showcase all of her talents. I very much love Katie O'Brien, and I hope that this is going to be a sign to other studios, other casting people that like she's it. She's got the it factor, and they need to be putting her in more movies.
Yeah. I just realized that I don't think we've spoiled anything yet. So if anybody wants to jump ahead to the Rose Glass interview, I don't think there are any spoilers in that conversation really either. But I do want to get into some spoilery stuff with you here, BJ. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, but you want to just listen to that interview, just go ahead and skip ahead now. This character that she plays, Jackie, Katie O'Brien plays this character named Jackie, she seems like pretty cool. You know, she kind of like rolls into this town, and her relationship with Kristen Stewart's character, Lou, feels like really lovely and genuine. And then she starts making progressively worse decisions, not because she's a villain or like a femme fatale in the kind of classic noir trope sense or anything, but because she's taking more and more steroids to prepare for this bodybuilding competition. So there's this idea of like, her body is being corrupted, that is visualized in a really fascinating way with this sort of like close-up bulging and like incredible sound design in this movie. So I just wanted to know what you thought about, you know, the more like technical aspects of the filmmaking.
Oh my God. The way that this movie views muscles is something like this has been like a great year for this between the Iron Claw and now this of movies that understand how to present muscular frames without it feeling lecherous, which I really like because whenever she, you know, hulks out, so to speak, she very much like the camera looks at her with adoration and like wants the audience to be in awe of her, even though there is something inherently body horror about bodybuilding, because you are stretching your body and strengthening it to limits that are kind of outside of the realm of reality for the majority of people. Mm-hmm. And so to see it presented in this way, I thought was really brilliant because it's forcing you to look at the way that the body is bulging and be like, this is unnatural and this should be creepy and gross, but I'm so fascinated by this because it's also incredible. And I love how effortlessly this movie walks that line.
That's interesting because I found like, I thought that the camera work, I guess more in like wide shots of the Jackie character, like when she's working out and stuff like that. I thought that was where I found the camera to be very sort of, you know, adoringly presenting her and like, you know, really wanting the audience to revel in just like how incredibly jacked she is and how amazing she looks and all of that, but not in that sort of lecherous way. But then I thought that when it sort of punched in and did those like super close up moments of, you know, certain muscles bulging and you kind of see like veins going nuts and stuff after the steroids really come into play in a major way in the movie, I thought that was the movie saying like, basically giving us warning signs for things to come, you know, like these sort of like foreshadowing moments of like stuff is building up here. This balloon is blowing up and it's going to pop at some point, and it's going to be pretty hardcore when it does. And it almost sounds like Venom or something is inside, you know, the Marvel character Venom, it like is inside or trying to burst its way out or something, because it's the squelching and the noise.
The sound design in this movie is bananas effective.
And then, okay, so that I think transitions us a little bit into one of the last things I want to talk about with you, is just the fantasy imagery, which we alluded to before, but I'll spoil now. So like there's a moment where Jackie basically gives birth to a full grown Lou out of her mouth in this drug induced vision. And then of course, like the giant stuff at the end. So I wondered what you made of that. Like that is certainly this movie, like taking a swing, you know, like the rest of the visual language of the movie does not necessarily, set up the fact that that stuff is coming. Although I think there are maybe like a couple of tiny hints along the way. There's a moment, again, full spoilers here, right after Dave Franco's character
gets obliterated.
Yes, just gets completely crushed,
just bodied.
Where it seems like Jackie is larger than she actually is, and it's like a really subtle, like a quick shot or something, but it seemed like, you know, in like Photoshop or something, how you can like grab the corner of a frame and like just drag it a little bit to extend the image. It sort of seemed like that was happening to Jackie's character. She was just like a little bit, you know, maybe like a foot taller than normal or something like that. But then obviously at the very end of the movie, there's this like full blown giant imagery there. And I was just, wondering what you thought about that.
So I'm obsessed with it because there's like 75 different reads that I could apply to Jackie the Kaiju Woman, which I think is so fascinating. And again, why I really like Rose Glass as a filmmaker, because her movies don't offer easy answers and you do have to sit and think about it and look about it in a bunch of different ways. But for me personally, I view it as, you know, this is how she feels. This is how she believes her power to be exerted. Like when you are socialized as a woman, you are told from birth that you are weaker than everyone else around you, that you need to be on the defensive, that offense is not an option. And so to see this person like take control, be the biggest person in the room, be the offensive player in the room, like there is something so empowering and like life affirming to experience that it feels like you're invincible at that point. And so to me, that's how I was viewing it, as like, she's invincible at this point. Like nothing can touch her, nothing can hurt her. And also it is this kind of like power of love thing of there are a few things stronger that, you know, that than love. I think a lot about how, you know, people report being like a parent and, you know, your kid's trapped under a car and suddenly you get like this mama bear strength and you can lift a car to save your kid. Well, when you love somebody that much, like you can blow up to a kaiju size and prevent their dad from killing them.
Yeah.
like it very much felt like a personification of that, of this is how it feels. So you're going to see how this feels.
Yeah, I had the same read on it. Like, I think my brain it's been so poisoned by just the way that more modern movies have treated us to take everything so literally, that like for a while in that final confrontation with Ed Harris's character, I was like, wait a second, is this literal? Like, does this movie kind of want me to think that this is actually happening? Because even from the very beginning of the film, you know, it takes place in this sort of desolate New Mexico town, and there's a lot of like star imagery, and you know, like it seems, I think you mentioned in the interview with Rose Glass, like the sort of Roswell connection, and it just seems like maybe aliens could conceivably come into play if this movie wanted to take like a really hard left turn or something. So I was like, is this like a legitimate, you know, a real thing that I'm actually witnessing here? But then I ultimately settled very quickly on, oh no, this is just, how she feels. And ultimately I came to the same read as you. But I did wonder about like the shot at the very end of the movie, or pretty close to the very end, one of the final shots, where the two female characters are gigantic and running essentially through the clouds and like reaching back and sort of holding each other's hand and moving forward, because the visual language of the movie up until that point had kind of indicated that the steroid use and, you know, some of the, I guess, more negative aspects of the crime saga and stuff were contributing to that. And it was kind of like, the movie doesn't want you to be, the movie doesn't want you to think, hey, Jackie, keep taking those steroids because everything's A-okay. You know what I mean? Like it I think the film is on Jackie's side in seeing her as like a victim of these drugs that she's taking. But then by the time you get to the very end of the movie and both of these characters are these giants running through, it kind of seems like the meaning behind what that means and what it took to get there has kind of shifted into like a good thing. This is actually a triumphant moment for these characters. And this is something that I was thinking about after I was watching the movie. So it's not like it held me up in the moment or anything, but I was wondering if you thought about that, I guess if you would call it an inconsistency or just like a shift, or I don't know if you have any thoughts on that at all.
For me, I think in this situation, this is the ultimate of the fantasy. And the way that I know that it is the ultimate fantasy is the fact that Jackie is wearing a bodybuilding competition bikini and Lou is wearing a sequined sports bra. Lou does not own anything sequined ever. So this is how we know it is not grounded in reality.
Yeah.
But to see them kind of frolicking and feeling larger than life and feeling invincible, I think it was less about the steroids and more about the freedom of Lou getting out from underneath the thumb of her father and his like crime syndicate. Jackie may not have won the bodybuilding competition, but she has proven and seen like she's the biggest, you know, that she's ever going to be. She feels as large and powerful as, you know, she's ever wanted, because ultimately that's what she's always wanted, is to feel, you know, this power, and now she's felt it. And so, you know, they're heading off to start their lives without any of that baggage anymore. There's something very freeing and it's very, you know, top of the world sort of sensation. And the fact that it's, they've got like the, in the background of the, like the Northern Lights, even though like they can't have the Northern Lights, they're in New Mexico. I just thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, they're like inflated by the power of love or something. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to mention before we get into the interview that you wrote an article called The 10 Best Movies About Buff Women Ranked, including Love Lies Bleeding. I just wondered if you wanted to set that piece up or provide any context in case people wanted to check that one out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if people don't know this already, I am also a massive fan of professional wrestling. I'm a massive fan of just large women in general, like that Steven Universe song, Giant Woman, like shocked I didn't write it. So the list is me looking at 10 movies about buff women. And I mean, like they are the center of the movie. They're not just like a random character off to the side. They are the main character. And if not the main character, they're at least like one of the big major baddies. And I looked at everything from live action to anime. I shouted out a documentary in here. There are so many other movies that could have been included on this list, but I felt like this was a really good primer to cover a lot of bases. And I hope if you are somebody who appreciates buff women and are not intimidated by buff women, that this is a list you'll enjoy.
Excellent. Okay, so I'm going to link to that. I'm also going to link to our review of Love Lies Bleeding from Sundance, which Bill Bria wrote, and it is just a terrific review. Really great stuff, especially for a festival setting where like you have a bunch of time constraints and everything. I was very impressed with what Bill was able to do with that review. So check that out, even if you have seen the movie already. And let's take a break, and then we'll be right back with the Rose Glass interview. Okay, so this is BJ's conversation with Love Lies Bleeding writer-director Rose Glass.
Well, hello. My name is BJ Colangelo. I'm coming to you from Slash Film. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Oh, doing pretty okay. Very excited to talk to you about this movie. Massive fan of Love Lies Bleeding, massive fan of St. Maud. So this is a great way to start my day.
Thank you. All right, thank you.
So I do want to start a little bit with St. Maud and how, you know, the release of St. Maud was a little unconventional, to say the least, because of the pandemic. But it became one of these mysterious movies that everyone was like, if there's one thing I'll never forgive the pandemic for, it's the ability to have seen St. Maud in the theater with all my friends. And now you have Love Lies Bleeding, which has this very, you know, had this very anticipated release. So I'm curious if you could speak to how you as a director processed these releases differently based on their circumstances.
I guess I feel like I didn't really do much processing of the whole Saint Maud thing. It was just so surreal the way it happened. So this time around, I guess the main difference has just been feeling a little bit more on top of things, and like I've got some vague idea of what's going to happen next, and just actually speaking to people in person, although I know we're on a Zoom now. It was just so weird. I don't know how else to say it with the Saint Maud thing. It was kind of, because it already felt so weird to have like actually made a film.
Right.
And the, you know, and then it got picked up by A24, and they were planning, I think, quite a wide release, and it felt crazy. And everyone kept being like, this never happens to an English debut. This is amazing. And I was like, oh, wow. And then we were literally, you know, we planned doing this whole like press trip thing and like booked flights to LA and all this kind of stuff. And then, yeah, the it was like, oh, Trump's travel ban came in. And I don't know, just obviously we all know what happened. But at that point, it was just so kind of like, it felt like such a once in a lifetime thing, the whole, you know, making this film and getting to go out and promote it. And then for it to coincide so perfectly with another once in a lifetime, we hope, thing. So I think I didn't process it at all. And just, I was living with some friends at the time. So I was just, I don't know, kind of just sort of stoned and surprised for several weeks afterwards, just sort of not, none of it felt real. Anyway, sorry, I'm waffling a bit, but so it was so weird. And yeah, this time, so I just finished doing the equivalent of what we would have done then for Loveless Bleeding, doing this sort of press for a week. And to be honest, maybe I prefer doing it from home via laptop. I don't have much of an answer, and it's all very weird.
Definitely. I mean, making movies in general is also just a weird experience of getting that done, working so hard on this art, and then suddenly, you know, you let it out into the world, and then it, to some extent, no longer belongs to you, which is wild. And so I was thinking about when the trailer first dropped for Love Lies Bleeding, and people saw, you know, what's going on in this movie. What was that experience for you like of seeing, you know, the general public react to this thing that's, you know, it's finally out there and people can see it?
It was really nice, because I guess inevitably by the time you get to that point of making a film, you've been so close to it for so long. All I can see is like the things of like, oh, fuck, I wish I'd done that differently, or I wish we'd done, you know, X, Y, and Z, but, you know, lots of little things. And you sort of, you know, I'm really pleased and proud of how it's turned out, but I've definitely been too close to it for a while. So you sort of forget that, oh, yes, Ed looks extraordinary, you know, and just people reacting fresh to things which, you know, when you wrote them and did them, were all, it's, you know, it's like, oh yes, I was hoping that would be funny, I was hoping that would be surprising. But all of those kinds of, you know, if I watch the film now, it's just with like a blank non-reactive kind of expression. So yeah, it's lovely people reacting to things actually fresh and surprising, especially, yeah, I think probably the looks as well, particularly Ed's hair. I'd forgotten how mad he looks.
I love that you brought up the reactions, because when I saw this movie for the first time, it was for a screening that A24 lovingly invited me to for Galentine's Day. And so the audience was mostly other lesbians in Los Angeles, a lot of sapphics, a lot of like Kristen's personal friends.
Yeah.
And it became very apparent how many people in this room came very excited for a lesbian love story, not realizing how hard into genre this movie twists. So it was very delicious to be in this room and kind of feel an entire room realize at the same time, oh, this movie doesn't fuck around. Okay, let's recalibrate my brain here for a second. So my question for you on this is, you know, I love the ultra violence that we see in this. How do you decide how far you're going to go with some of these more violent actions, what we're going to see, what's going to be hidden, what's going to be given that grotesquely beautiful sound design? How do you determine that?
It's kind of a sort of thing you're weighing up and balancing as you're going along. I mean, from the beginning, I knew and was saying to everybody who came on board, and particularly like Veronica, my co-writer, it's like, you know, no one should be afraid of taking big swings. I knew it would want, you know, I wanted it to be very melodramatic and quite heightened and pulpy. So I knew that having a lot of violence was an integral part of that, on a kind of slightly operatic kind of scale. And I don't know, it's, that's the sum of the sort of stuff that I find the most fun to do. A lot of what you show and what you don't show comes down to sort of practicalities, really. So like there's, I don't know if this is a spoilery thing or not, but anyway, when somebody gets killed first in the film, that's, I think we'd had versions where the moment that they're getting killed, you sort of see it a bit more explicitly, but you know, the, I'm sorry, I'm gesturing to you, that doesn't translate well in sound. But you know, it's like, oh, then we'll have to make a big prosthetic of this head and maybe combine that with VFX, and it was a bit too expensive. So some of it plays off screen. And again, yeah, then Paul Davies, our sound designer, takes over. And you know, sometimes leaving stuff up to people's imaginations, I think, has a better impact. But, and then you get this, then the sort of reveal of the aftermath of how this person's been killed kind of becomes a bit more of a, like a gag, which seems to get quite a nice combination of grimacing and laughing, which I'm quite happy with. Yeah, you sort of choreograph it all a bit like a dance.
Oh yeah, our screening, it was a combination of very loud, audible, full breath in gasps and plenty of laughter, and also the nervous laughter because they were so, you know, on edge about it, which was really, really a wonderful, like, thing.
They were like, am I allowed to laugh? Can I laugh at this joke?
I think that's definitely part of it, because this movie, for as much as there's so much, there's a lot of intensity in this movie, there's also so much humor in this movie. And I do think that there is this fine line where people are like, I don't know if I'm allowed to laugh at this. But I think once they give themselves over, you know, that's why this movie, I think, works so well for me personally, is because you do get a little bit of both. Like, I loved that, you know, the first time that we see Lou, she's reading Macho Sluts. Yeah. So I would love to know the thought process behind that specific book, because that's definitely a, if you know, you know, kind of book. But if you don't know, at least the title is
check
very,
it out.
Yeah, the title itself is very attention getting. So why that book of all of the books?
To be honest, it kind of was the title, because I think when I first saw that, I hadn't heard of that book until I saw it in a bookshop, and it was just that title on the spine. I was like, oh, gotta get me a copy of that. And yeah, it's these quite, and it was not read it, it's a series of quite intense sort of BDSM erotic short stories. Which are kind of wonderful and interesting. And it just felt like the sort of thing that maybe Lou would be reading, as probably like in a sort of small town, probably again, like pre-internet, you know, if you're having to like seek out specific little bits of kind of culture that you identify with, it sort of feels maybe a bit more potent. So I was like figuring if she manages to find a copy of that book, or if she manages to find a copy of a particular record, like Robin Gristle or Psychic TV, like to her in this town, that would all be a bit more meaningful to her. And to be honest, like the title, even me and Veronica, we kind of had it as a sort of unofficial working title while we were first kicking the idea around, but quite quickly shifted to Love, Life, Breeding. But again, I think that sort of helped, that title in a way helped inform the title we landed on in the end. I guess there's a similar kind of wanted whatever title we had to sort of feel a bit like it could be like the title of a dirty or pulpy kind of paperback or something.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it ended up being weirdly poetic, because this movie also is dealing so much with relationships that to outsiders, you might be able to look at and go, okay, yes, immediate red flag, this is super unhealthy. But when you're in it, you know, this is all you know, or this is, you know, what feels right for you, even if it's not always good for you, or if other people might interpret it as not good for you. And so I was really fascinated by all of these different relationship dynamics. One in particular, Lou Senior, and then, you know, Kristen Stewart Lou, there is this very specific dynamic that I don't think is explored in film very often, which is the father and the daughter, where the father is also giving the legacy name to the daughter. That doesn't happen very often, but I'm fascinated with legacy names just in general, and like the weird pressures you put on your children before they're even born by giving them legacy names. But I'm curious if you could speak to that specific relationship dynamic, because like I said, we just don't see it very often.
I think, I mean, it's sort of something that kind of gradually emerged as we were writing it, but I guess maybe initially it came from, but like the sort of more familiar version of this kind of story, given where and when it sets, you know, if a character like Lou has all this beef with her dad, I feel like the sort of easiest way to do it would be that he's just very conservative patriarch and disapproves of her being a lesbian or something like this, or her kind of gender presentation or whatever. And that just felt like that wasn't the direction I was interested in it going. And yeah, I kind of thought it would maybe be a bit more interesting if, yeah, the father-daughter sort of relationship where actually she's a bit like his little protege, or at one point had been, sort of stuff you hopefully piece together throughout the film. But yeah, I guess it's sort of, it sort of goes to explaining how she kind of got stuck in this town as well, and how, I don't know, most basically, I guess it's sort of saying that try as hard as we might, a lot of us just inevitably end up turning into our parents, or we all have a lot more in common with our parents than we maybe like to admit. And I like the idea of her having this very clear-cut thing from early on, and us as the audience being aligned with her, like, my dad's this terrible evil guy and I'm nothing like him. But then gradually finding out that actually they've maybe got a bit more in common than she'd like to think. And at one point she was kind of, you know, next in line to sort of inherit the kingdom of whatever his kind of shady criminal enterprise is. So I like the idea of him. Also, I kind of figure, I sort of imagine that maybe he kind of just figured she's the oldest. Or was she the youngest? I can't remember. He's sort of a bit like, he wanted a son to be his protege, but he got a daughter instead. So he's like, I'll just call her Lou anyway. I'll just give her the same name as me anyway, and then see how it goes. It just seemed like fun.
Yeah, I really loved watching the two of them together, especially in, you know, in like the hospital room scene, because I think that is where you completely understand their dynamic. It and you can almost look at it and go, I know exactly how he parented her. Like, it is all very, very clear, which I think is wonderful. This, you know, delicious bit of rebellion against your father, but it's not just against your father. It's also rebelling against, you know, that nurture that's inside you and kind of crafting you to be more like your father. I'm so much like my dad. It's like disgusting sometimes. Like, underneath this makeup, I look like an old Italian man, and I just have dealt with that with, you know, that's my cross to bear.
Yeah, I apparently just have the same face as my dad, which is very disturbing. You sort of don't realize it until you're older and you're like, what? And then in fact, yeah, I've said this in interviews before, but then apparently through pure coincidence, the way that Ed looks in the film is kind of weirdly similar to apparently how Kristen's dad, he's got a similar hairdo. So that's all a bit odd. But yeah, I like the idea of you being able to imagine the two of them as like a weird little sort of double act. I kind of wish there were a few more scenes of them together. I'm kind of like, oh, I wish we'd done a scene where you sort of like saw him teaching her to shoot a gun for the first time kind of thing. The idea of her being like, yeah, my dad's so cool, I'm gonna go and be a gangster too, but then obviously she couldn't quite hack in. I was just living in denial.
It's difficult when, you know, you have empathy and a soul. Makes contract killing a little difficult.
Yeah, too bad.
You know, this film is set in, you know, New Mexico, and it is dusty and sweaty and hot. And, you know, there's also this inherent like alien nature to New Mexico because of like Roswell and all of these sorts of things. So I was curious if New Mexico as the setting was always intentional, or if this came about because, you know, the tax incentives exist in places like New Mexico and Louisiana, and how that affected the story from script to screen.
I knew I wanted it to be set in broadly that area of the country, but it wasn't specifically written as being in New Mexico, you know, sort of broadly southwest somewhere. So we did consider other places, and, you know, part of it, yeah, tax incentives and stuff does certainly help tip over. But going and visiting Albuquerque for the first time, it was just a very kind of light bulb kind of, yes, this feels, I can picture it all happening here. And I loved filming there. And I mean, to be honest, the whole alien thing, like, I was an idiot and didn't even put the whole sort of Roswell thing together until we were there. And then I was like, why does everyone keep talking about aliens? But weirdly, I think it kind of did feed into the story, because not very directly, it all kind of like happened piece by piece, but, you know, there's a bit in the film where they go and dump this car with the body in it in the place we filmed it. It was like in a gypsum mine, so they mine all that stuff that you make plaster with or whatever. So But the landscape that, I mean, the big crack in the earth, that's all VFX. But the landscape around it just felt very lunar. So then, and I think because of that, oh yeah, and then I realized, I was trying to come up with a name for the gun range and called it Louisville again. Lou's dad is a narcissist and just kind of calling everything off himself. And then apparently Louisville is the name of a crater on the moon. So then that's why the town, we called it Crater. All this stuff I was only doing, like, when we were out there, we were already prepping. And then I think because of the sort of lunar looking landscape of this bit that we filmed that section in, then that fed into in post, we had all these big wide shots of the gym, which just had big black empty skies. And it's like, well, let's just pump loads of stars into that. And then obviously later there's a sort of fantastical moment in the stars. And some of the music feeds into that. There's this music by this Japanese woman, Shiho Yabuki, which all sounds very sci-fi, I think. And I kind of like the idea of Lou and Jackie sort of being a bit like little aliens who are sort of lonely in the cosmos and then kind of find each other. That's kind of like a slightly more warped version of like Star-Crossed Lovers, I guess, like a sort of alien version.
Yeah, I mean it does feel very much like a cosmic love story, especially because, Jackie kind of appears out of nowhere. I mean, in any other movie, this is a superhero origin story of, falls from the sky and, this otherworldly body, which I think is just so perfect. And so I am a lifelong fan of professional wrestling. My sister was a bodybuilder. I've been surrounded by giant women my whole life. So I have such an affinity for, the canon of buff women cinema. And I did a list for Slash Film and I put Love Lies Bleeding as my new favorite. And I was like, I promise this is not recency
Oh,
bias.
brilliant.
It just is the best buff movie.
Thank you.
but something that I find fascinating, and I think your film touches on this a little bit, is that bodybuilding is also a bit, it's a bit of smoke and mirrors because when people are at like their peak presentation, they're also their weakest because they're super dehydrated. A lot of the muscle is built for aesthetic, not for actual strength. And I love the way that you showcase just transformation and body and the way that the camera, like, it looks upon Katie in a way that is adoring and wants you to be in awe of her, not so much leering. So I am just curious to hear your approach about this physicality, this transformation, just like the aesthetics of body in general.
I mean, I guess, but I've always been interested in bodies, I guess, in film, and like how the sort of weird different relationships people can have with them. I think like the initial sort of whole thing that made me want to do the film was the idea of doing something about a female bodybuilder. And I guess sort of slightly more specifically, the idea of somebody, thinking of Jackie's kind of dream of, not in the literal sense of who I want to win this competition, but more as someone who just really wants to transform themselves into like a god or a statue or something, which I guess is sort of what bodybuilders are doing. They're like sculpting themselves. I think there's that great bit in like Pumping Iron where Arnold Schwarzenegger is talking about it. It's kind of like my muscle, my no, is it my muscles are the clay, and I'm sculpting myself. And so that just so the idea of it having this of treating this kind of muscularity as being something kind of godlike, I guess, or sort of like trying to raise yourself above sort of weak humanity, kind of seen the hook. So that was always, I guess, the attitude that I was approaching showing her body, I guess, was sort of somebody trying to create a kind of some kind of armor, and it to have this kind of slightly mystical, godlike feeling to it. So what else to say? I
I
mean, filming
mean,
that competition was sort of one of my favorite parts of it, and all the stuff that you're saying about bodybuilding, that was definitely all the stuff I guess that intrigued me about it, the more I found out about it, that yeah, there's this slightly surreal sort of what's the word? It is a strange thing. It's sort of a performance art more than a sport, I guess. And yeah,
yeah,
it's sort of,
definitely.
I guess also the idea of like, I don't know, getting strong for the sake of getting strong, or ambition for ambition's sake can be kind of hollow, I suppose. So that's, I guess, why which I think the film sort of looks at in more ways than just the bodybuilding. But yeah, it's a strange old art form, but fascinating, I think.
Yeah, definitely. There's a joke that I've been running with for a while, is that like the ultimate bodybuilder is Dr. Frankenstein, because he literally is building bodies. Yeah. But there is something weirdly, you know, science fiction or Frankensteinian, I guess is the word, of people who actually compete in bodybuilding. There is something almost monstrous, I think, to the general public when you get to this size, especially if you are a woman. Like you mentioned Pumping Iron, I think about like Pumping Iron 2 and the way that they talk about Bev Francis and how they don't want to like award her things because she looks too masculine. And, you know, sacrificing your femininity for sake of muscles is like the ultimate crime in, you know, puritanical, yeah, cisgender heteronormative America. But something that I loved so much about this is that in any other movie, I think a character like Katie would, or that Katie plays, like Jackie, would be presented as like so inherently masculine, and you do not do that in this movie. She has huge hair, she's got cute little, yeah, crop top, you know, while she's, you know, being a little waitress at the gun range. So was that an intentional choice for you, was to maintain the femininity of her presentation?
Yeah, and to be honest, like, you know, seeing the more kind of like masculine presenting version of the characters, where I think would also be fascinating. It was kind of, I feel like, but in the end, I think it was sort of like playing against Lou. We sort of wanted to play with the sort of juxtaposition of the kind of binaries that they both sort of represent. So yeah, we played with sort of having that sort of duality in her, I guess, just seemed sort of fun. And I guess the initial thing that had sort of, the initial imagery that I'd been seeing that had sort of made me go, ooh, this is something that I'd maybe want to write a story about, was photos of strong women, quote unquote, from like the 40s or 50s, where it was kind of, you know, like a sideshow attraction pretty much, but it was the, you know, before it was a competitive sport, but it was seeing these photos of women from that era who obviously had this amazing like 40s 50s kind of like pin curl, mm-hmm, hairdos with these amazingly muscular physique, and something about, I guess, the sort of juxtaposition of those kind of different gender characteristics, just that was just intriguing to me and sort of satisfying in some way. Yeah.
And I think this movie is also coming at like a really specifically, you know, wonderful kind of kismet moment where Muscle Mommies are having a big moment. And I think, yeah, it is because pro wrestling's becoming really popular again. And some of the main, you know, women are huge, like they're big women, and people are starting to become a little bit more open about being like, no, there's something to this. I don't think it's gross. I think it's actually kind of sexy, kind of hot. And so, yeah, it's been really fascinating watching other people react to this movie that are not, I guess, like within, you know, queer circles where big women have always been appreciated, but now suddenly, yeah, like straight men are like, no, I'm into it. Like, I'm into kind of going, oh, like beat me up. And I'm like, wow, okay. So I think there's something magical about this movie coming out now where it is finding an audience that I think normally would not, you know, be as open about pursuing it. So I'm curious if you could speak to some of the feedback that you've gotten from, I don't know, I guess audiences that you wouldn't normally expect to be super into a movie like this.
I mean, I haven't sort of spoken to enough people who've maybe seen it. It only came out like last week, but yeah, the general response has been, I'm glad people sort of seem to be, I don't know, this sounds too corny maybe, but I feel like it's a fairly like warm-hearted, kind of quite sweet film, really, underneath, yeah, all the blood and guts and everything. So I'm glad that people seem to be, I mean, obviously not everyone, but people, I don't know, people seem to really like get the characters and feel quite warmly towards them, which is, I don't know, what I'd hoped. I don't know, and also just, it's been a little, I guess not, it shouldn't have been surprising, but, you know, obviously there's been a lot of talk about how kind of Kristen and Katie look in the film and, oh, wow, we're so not used to seeing these characters in the centre of a film, which is true, but it's sort of, it makes me just realise that, like, just sort of brings home like how sort of ridiculous that is, because even like Katie and Kristen themselves are not kind of especially kind of crazy looking sort of people. It's like there's loads of women who work out and lift and are muscular and, you know, sort of way bigger than Katie is. And it's sort of, but I guess we're so not used to seeing them as the main characters in a film. I mean, I don't know, not that it's the first of anything, but it did sort of, I guess when you're writing the film and making the film, again, like what I was saying earlier, you know, all the kind of surprise element is taken out because it's just, that's the story we're telling. These are the characters and it's all very, you're just trying to get it done. So it's, I'm not quite sure what the conclusion of that point is, but that's been, it's been kind of, I sort of forgot that people would be so surprised by how they look in the film, but also, I'm glad that the next reaction that comes after that seems to be that they kind of like the film and find it in a warm-hearted, funny kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, so many of, I guess, like the women that I, you know, am in community with are people who are gender nonconforming, who, you know, have bodies and presentations that are, you know, outside of what Hollywood is normally going to put in a movie. So it's nice. It feels like I'm seeing my friends on screen, if that makes sense. But I do know that that's like, that's a new thing for so many people, which is exciting. And I think what's also very new is not the right word, but, you know, contentious is there's all of the discourse around sex scenes in film, which I am very much pro sex scenes in film, all the sex scenes in film. And this movie has a lot of sex in it. So I'm curious if you could speak to, you know, this sort of push that we've been seeing recently where people are trying to say that like sex scenes don't serve a purpose.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to me and completely nonsensical. And I'm kind of like, come on, like who, what, I don't know. I'm like, sex and violence is really important elements of cinema, and it's, you know, it's, well, just of life as well. Like, I don't know, and it's a romantic film. It's about a romantic relationship. People have sex. It's like, you know, it's part of, yeah, it seems weird and a bit prudish to me. And a bit sort of, I mean, I don't know, I guess a bit, if it's coming more from a reaction of, obviously there've been instances where people have felt that like the way sex scenes have been filmed hasn't been done in a good, cool way that makes people comfortable, which obviously it should do. And, you know, I sort of think that's a separate conversation. And, you know, things like, obviously it's now in the last few years become, you know, the given that you do these scenes, you have an intimacy coordinator, and it's like, yes, obviously, absolutely. And having not used one for St. Maud, we didn't have that. I didn't really have one sex scene in that, but anyway, it's, you know, I was a bit nervous of working with one for this one, but it was fantastic. And, you know, just made the whole process even more comfortable. But yeah, I don't know. I just always find like cinema, like maybe it's just because of the sort, my whole, probably like most filmmakers, it's something that you get excited about when you're a teenager, and usually a lot of the time as kind of a bit of a loser teenager, and you're sort of like living vicariously through, like, oh wow, you get to see all these kind of more exciting, transgressive kind of lives unfolding on screen that you wish you were doing. And I don't know, sex and violence is definitely a big part of that. And yeah, I don't know, the whole thing of seeing these people as like main characters on screens, I think a lot of this film has been like some weird sort of like teenage wish fulfillment of mine. I just know I would have loved to have seen these women on screen when I was younger, and for it to just be, you know, just a given that these are just cool, hot, gay women, and their sexuality isn't like the thing that's the big obstacle in a film. It's like, and they just get to do all the fun, sexy, violent stuff that I was enjoying watching other characters do as well.
Beautiful. Well, that is the time that I have with you today. And I think that was a perfect note to go out on, because I agree with you completely. And, you know, thank you so, so much again for talking with me, and congratulations on just yet another phenomenal movie. There is no sophomore slump for you.
Thank you so much. Really nice to talk to you.
All right. That was awesome, BJ. Any closing thoughts before we go here?
The only thing that I'll say is, you know, talking to Rose Glass was so wonderful because, like, her movies are so cerebral and so also viscerally intense, and she's so nice and so kind. And there's always this preconceived notion people have that if you are really into horror movies or if you like genre films, that like there's something wrong with you and you're like a weirdo, and like she's the nicest person. And you know, that's always been my experience with most people who make horror, is that people who make horror are like extremely well adjusted emotionally, because you kind of have to be to play in the sandbox.
Yeah, for sure. Do you know if Rose Glass has mentioned what she's working on next? Like, do you know if there's a story out there?
I have not heard, but she, you know, she's two for two for me. I love Saint Maud. Love Lies Bleeding. I love a little bit more, for, I mean, obvious reasons, but they're both fantastic movies. So whatever she does next, I'm first in line.
Hell yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about Love Lies Bleeding at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.